Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Global equity market plunge. That's how it's being described today. While the U.S. stock market stayed silent in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., markets around the world confirmed that the possibility of recession in this country is bad news for them, too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Grant Thornton, dedicated to serving their clients worldwide with a passion for the business of accounting. On the web at grantthornton.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Martin Luther King Day. It is Monday, the 21st of January. You know those photos you see of Wall Street traders worriedly looking up at their trading screens whenever the markets take a big tumble? Well, today's photos are similar, only the faces are from stock markets and streets around the world. Germany's DAX suffered its biggest decline since the worldwide downturn on September 11th, off more than 7%. Bombay, a record 7.5%. Hong Kong, 5.5%. Some analysts blamed global disappointment over the Bush administration's proposed stimulus plan. But as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London, where the FTSE 100 finished down more than 5%, there may be other, more alarming factors at work.
This was a day that stockbrokers would rather forget, the worst slide in share prices since 9/11. The optimistic mood of more recent years has vanished. We're in a bear market, says broker Howard Wealdon.
The irrational exuberance that we had through 2002 to 2006 has been now replaced very firmly by irrational fear.
Investors were not reassured by President Bush's stimulus package. Too little, too late was a widespread comment today. Fears of a deep recession in the US are growing, says analyst Richard Hunter.
It's one of those questions of just how badly is the US going to be hit, and what the market is saying today is that's going to have a fairly major impact on other global economies.
Markets were spooked by an even bigger worry about the so-called monoline insurers. Among other things, they insure against bonds going into default. A credit rating agency downgraded a big bond insurer last week. Stuart Fraser of brokers Bruin Dolphin says the fear is that widespread downgrades could trigger a full-blown banking crisis.
Whether that's right or wrong is another matter, but it certainly caused a feeling of panic because there is a feeling that really events will have to see themselves out and that there's not much anybody can really do about it.
Today's panic, he says, was exacerbated by the US holiday. He says there is a glimmer of hope that things may not seem quite so bad when the usually more optimistic American markets resume trading tomorrow. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
No doubt the debate over a stimulus package will intensify this week as Congress puts forth its own proposals. We've asked Tom Shapiro to outline the pros and cons with us. He's with the Institute on Assets and Social Policy at Brandeis. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What kind of good will this potentially do for lower income, lower middle class folks?
The goal, one of the goals of the stimulus, of any stimulus package, is to fuel the economy up in terms of its growth and in terms of the distribution of what people can buy, and especially the kinds of goods that get produced because of the stimulus. I am a little leery based on what happened in the last round of tax cuts.
So you're talking about when a taxpayer was getting $300 or a household was getting $600 in an actual check from the government.
That's correct. That's correct. Families earning under about $45,000 or $50,000 spent a large portion of that to pay off past consumption, not to look forward as much to future consumption on essential items that they, in fact, really need.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've had this natural experiment about what happens when that kind of stimulus package is put into place, and the results from where I'm looking at it and the data that I look at are not very good.
I assume that whether or not that happens really depends on how these stimulus proposals are structured. For example, I've heard some talk that, well, if you didn't pay taxes last year, then you're not going to get any sort of tax rebate, which of course excludes anyone from lower income families that didn't pay any tax last year.
That is precisely one of the major concerns of several of the Democratic contenders for the presidency, that those families, hardworking in most cases, working full-time jobs in many cases, more than one full-time job in some cases, still don't have incomes high enough to qualify for the kind of package that President Bush has in mind.
Every day we hear more about the possibility of recession. Maybe we're in one already. What does a stimulus package do to alleviate that?
There's been a squeeze, if you will, on America's middle class in the last 20 to 30 years or so. A Republican president putting a stimulus package on the board at this point allows everybody to have a legitimate voice about the concerns of the financial security and stability and long-term survivability of America's middle class. And I think that that is very important, because those issues, that reality of the way those families are living their lives, has been there for quite a while. Now there has been, in my personal estimation, hopefully a breakthrough of sorts that allows us to have that conversation in a way that is not reduced to ideology or orthodoxy.
Tom Shapiro is director of the Institute on Assets and Social Policy at Brandeis University. Thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You've heard of American Apparel, the clothing company that uses provocative photographs of half-naked men and women in its advertising. Well, this week, provocativeness gives way to salaciousness. The company's CEO, Dov Charney, has a court date to defend himself against accusations of sexual harassment by a former employee. Ashley Milne-Tite reports on what effect the lawsuit might have on the brand that's known for manufacturing its clothing in the U.S. and paying health insurance for its employees.
This is the fourth time Dov Charney has been accused of sexual harassment, but the first time a case has made it to court. His accuser says, among the things we can repeat on air, that he used degrading language towards women and wore only his underwear in several meetings with her. But retail consultant Paddy Powell says just look at the company's ads. Any potential employee must realize political correctness doesn't apply at American Apparel.
When you go work at a company, you have to fit with their culture. The culture doesn't fit with you. I'm not excusing it by any stretch of the imagination, because I think it's actually kind of hideous, but that is part of the culture of the company.
Powell says the clothing will continue to sell well regardless of the lawsuit because the brand is hip. But Robert Pasikoff of Brand Keys isn't so sure. He says American Apparel's core customers are in their teens and early 20s. They may not even know about the case yet.
Nothing travels faster than the speed of light except bad news on the internet. And these days, it depends on how the social networking groups view this kind of an event.
But retail consultant Howard Davidowitz says if anything hits profits, it won't be the outcome of a sexual harassment case.
As long as the company is doing well, I think Charney is golden. I think the risks to the company are they are in a very weak sector. Teen apparel is getting murdered almost across the board.
He says if Charney had to tone down his risque marketing campaign, now that would hurt sales. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Wall Street, as we mentioned, was closed for the holiday. We'll have more details on the global slide when we do the numbers. Job cuts and economic woes are fueling a new spate of immigration talk in the South. Republican Buddy Witherspoon is challenging fellow Republican and incumbent Lindsey Graham for the Senate seat in South Carolina. Witherspoon's campaign recently launched an ad skewering Graham for his immigration policy. The ad begins with the words, "Press one for English."
Gracias, Lindsey Graham.
Muchas gracias, Lindsey Graham.
Lindsey Graham.
Enough is enough. It's time for a senator with South Carolina values. Buddy Witherspoon, a proven conservative Republican.
Commentator Carrie Howley says that kind of tough tactic will only hinder economic growth in South Carolina.
An ad like this can really challenge your sense of fourth grade geography. Is a state 1,300 miles from the Mexican border really under threat from an onslaught of polite, grateful Spanish speakers? Only 3 in 100 South Carolinians are Hispanic or Latino, and far fewer are undocumented. But small as it is, South Carolina's Mexican-born population increased 6 times over in 15 years. When communities unused to newcomers sense a growing population, politicians can whip up a sense of impending crisis. Even a thank you is suddenly sinister. According to a study by the Immigration Policy Center, almost 80% of the localities that have discussed anti-immigrant ordinances had below the national average of Latino population share in 2000. In other words, it's often not the places with massive immigrant populations that seem most worried. It's the places with new immigrant populations. It's easy to assume the worst about the immigrants who lead the pack. They've got less of a support network to lean back on, so assimilation can take longer. They're still working to gain the human capital and social networks that newcomers always accumulate over time. But as states with established Latino communities have shown repeatedly, rates of English acquisition, educational attainment, and home ownership skyrocket with successive generations. If South Carolina wants to gauge the benefits and costs of migration across its borders, it might look to Arkansas, another southern state with a new and growing population of immigrants. Even taking into account the costs of education and health services, immigrants have had a positive impact on the state's budget. The immigrant population has provided a pool of young, highly productive new laborers. These workers have boosted the state's manufacturing output to the tune of $1.4 billion. We should be liberalizing our immigration policies, not scaring away entrepreneurial people who will pay taxes, provide jobs, and support local businesses. As South Carolina's immigrants adapt and prosper, the state will increasingly need to thank them.
Carrie Howley is a senior editor at Reason Magazine. Tell us what you think at our website. It's marketplace.org. For years, French farmers have led the charge against globalization, but now some are being forced to admit their best choice is go along to get along. Believe it or not, the front line in this battle includes miniature pickles, cornichons. They're considered the national condiment in France, but now cornichon farmers are learning to compete with producers from countries like India. Anita Elash reports from the Burgundy region of France.
À droite, c'est là que les cornichons vont être semés cette année.
Florent Jeanquin has been growing tiny cucumbers to make cornichons on this parcel of land for 27 years. He used to be one of nearly 30 cornichon farmers in the area. They sold most of their produce directly to French food processor Maya Mora. Its factory is just down the street. But then Maya Mora changed hands and its way of doing business.
In 2004,
Maya Mora told us it was over. They would stop contracting with us because our cornichons were expensive, and they could buy cornichons for 40% less in India. So they said they were ending their relationship with us.
When Maya Mora stopped buying cornichons from the Apwani farmers, the growers lost 80% of their business. Now Jeanquin is one of just 3 remaining cucumber farmers in France. To survive, they've adapted to the global market. They spent nearly $370,000 to buy a warehouse and equipment to sort cucumbers by size. Then they learned how to grow bigger cucumbers for other markets and when to pick them at their best. Now their produce is shipped to Germany for pickling and sold in Eastern Europe.
It makes me sick at heart to think my cornichons have to travel 300 to 500 kilometers to be put in jars when there's a factory right at my feet.
Farmers in France are struggling to compete in world markets. With protective tariffs gone, they've been hard hit by imports from countries like China and India. Agriculture economist Jean-Christophe Bureau says that's because production costs in France haven't come down.
And because of their production costs, and mainly because of the labor costs, the imports are really much cheaper. So there's really a broad range of fruits and vegetables that now are more and more imported rather than produced locally.
Some farmers are targeting another new market at home, the French gourmet. Alain Renaudin, a restaurant owner in the Appoigny region, refuses to eat or serve Indian-grown cornichons. He buys his cucumbers directly from Jeanquin and makes his own pickles. He says importing cornichons from India is like taking the mustard out of Dijon.
I think it would be a shame for France to see the French cornichon disappear completely from our territory. If we call ourselves the leading gastronomic country in the world, we have to continue to make our traditional dishes with products grown on our own land.
The challenge in the next few years will be to see if farmers can do that and still earn a decent living. In the Burgundy region of France, I'm Anita Elash for Marketplace.
Coming up, sports and math add up to a new finance game for kids.
And we can't overwhelm someone and make it daunting. And that's why I think the game packaging really helps get this education message across.
But first, let's do the numbers. It is a small world after all, and today that meant everybody lost a whole lot of cash. U.S. markets were closed for Martin Luther King Day, but indexes around the globe plummeted. Asian markets took the brunt of it. As Stephen Beard mentioned, India's Sensex dropped a whopping 7.5%. In China, the Shanghai Composite plunged more than 5%. European markets saw their worst one-day decline since 9/11. In addition to the drops in Germany and Britain, France's CAC 40 dove near 7%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Siemens. From generators that power cities to light bulbs for homes, from factory automation to medical diagnostics, Siemens' 70,000 U.S. employees providing solutions for America. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert. Mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Senate Finance Committee holds the first of two hearings on strengthening America's economy. It's the 35th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, the historic U.S. Supreme Court decision legalizing abortion. And will the show go on? Oscar nominations are announced in Los Angeles amid strike uncertainty. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Schools may be out for the holiday today, but here's a pop quiz for you. Where does your tap water come from? If you didn't immediately answer, you have company. Most of us take our drinking water for granted, but the smart money doesn't. Predictions of drought and dwindling supplies are turning investors' attention to the oceans as a reliable drinking source. Desalination isn't cheap, but as Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, companies are diving in.
If we could ever competitively, at a cheap rate, get fresh water from salt water, that it would be in the long-range interests of humanity, which would really dwarf any other scientific accomplishment.
Turns out John F. Kennedy wasn't just intrigued with flying to the moon. He also poured federal dollars into finding an affordable way to desalt ocean water. Turns out landing on the moon was easier.
The biggest rap against desalination has been the energy requirements.
That's Tom Pankratz, an industry consultant. He says flushing the salt out of ocean water still takes boatloads of energy. That's why desalinated water costs at least three times more than water from traditional sources, and why it's often seen as a technology of last resort for parched countries like Saudi Arabia or Israel. But that's changing.
We're standing here on the shore of the largest reservoir in the world.
When Peter McLagan looks at the Pacific Ocean, he sees a business opportunity. McLagan is an exec with Poseidon Resources, a company betting on a drier future. Poseidon is spending $300 million to build a desalination plant here in Carlsbad, California. If all goes according to plan, it'll churn out enough drinking water for 300,000 residents every year.
50, 100 years from now, I don't think that the coastal communities of Southern California are going to be importing water anymore. And the reason why I say that is that I don't think there's enough water to go around.
Poseidon and others investing in ocean as tap water expect this industry to more than triple its global output over the next decade. They say a growing world population is sucking up water at an alarming rate, and the oceans offer an unlimited supply. William Brennan runs equity funds that invest in the water industry.
In the United States especially, if you take a look at the Southwest and the Midwest part of the U.S., they right now are probably about 50 years into a 500-year drought, and they know that the water situation will only become worse.
Right now, hundreds of small companies you've never heard of are gearing up to sell more desalination technology. Big global conglomerates see future profits in seawater, too, like Siemens in Germany and GE here in the U.S. GE is selling a filtration technology called Z-Weed, says GE's Jason Kaiser.
It removes all sorts of non-dissolved constituents such as bacteria, viruses, algae, all the critters that come along with ocean water.
Construction on the Carlsbad plant is slated to start later this year. Environmental groups recently filed a lawsuit over the plant. Poseidon insists the litigation won't significantly disrupt the project's completion date. 17 more desalination plants have been proposed along the California coast, but investor William Brennan says the industry still needs to cut costs.
The biggest challenge that we see right now for the industry is to increase energy efficiency of the process faster than the price of generating electricity from fossil fuel rises.
Poseidon has agreed to sell cities its water for the same price they pay for regular water. It's bet that the price of all water is going up. Poseidon is predicting it'll increase at least 5.5% a year. As of today, though, I think the glass of ocean water I tasted at the Carlsbad site is the priciest H2O I've ever had.
It doesn't have much taste, does it?
No, I think it tastes great.
Well, one thing it doesn't taste is salty. In Carlsbad, California, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
And Sarah has pictures and links to more information about changing salt water into drinking water on our website. It's marketplace.org. Super Bowl 42 is set. The New England Patriots and New York Giants won the AFC and NFC title games over the weekend. No doubt players on both teams are looking forward to the possibility of not only a championship ring, but the nice fat bonuses that often go with it. If they need some help managing that money, they could call on some high school kids in New Orleans. They were participants in a program sponsored by the NFL and Visa called Financial Football. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has the play-by-play from the Superdome.
I sat down to play financial football on the computer with Mike Noble, an investment advisor with Crescent Sterling.
Get to choose what team you want to be.
Being from New Orleans, Noble picks the Saints from the list of football teams.
What city are you from?
I'm from Los Angeles.
Good luck.
I settle on the Raiders as my proxy. The way it works is that in order to advance down the field, each team has to answer questions about money matters. Noble says financial football does a good job covering the basics, but he wonders if kids will expect better video game graphics.
The interaction is not as sophisticated as Xbox, but you get the point.
Nonetheless, Noble says it could be a valuable tool.
I've always found it hard to engage young people in this kind of conversation. I would just be curious to see what kind of results they're getting.
I got to see for myself. Seniors from rival schools gathered in the Saints locker room at the Superdome. 16-year-old Jacques Laundrie was representing McDonough 35 High. I asked him what kinds of video games he normally plays.
Football, basketball, sports, basically sports.
He dreams of being a pro football player. So it's a big deal for him when Saints cornerback Mike McKenzie comes in and gives both teams an economic pep talk. McKenzie confessed that he didn't know how to budget when he went to college.
I had this credit card. Man, did I have this credit card in me? I mean, I had instant cash. I was like, all right, take the guys on out. We going to eat. Anybody got money? Nope. We'll just put it on here.
He fell into debt. He owed money even before he turned pro and collected a paycheck worth $300,000.
Before I knew it, before I made it through my rookie year, I was broke.
After he spoke, McKenzie took a seat with the team from McDonough High.
Are y'all ready for some football?
Whitney Martin reads the financial football questions to each team.
Which of these is not a liability? Not a liability. Paycheck, credit card balance, hospital bill, or money you owe a friend?
In the end, McDonough High took it.
That is a touchdown.
The kids definitely got into it. But does the game cover everything they need to know? I put the question to investment advisor Mike Noble.
The only shortcoming from my perspective is that it doesn't include many types of savings vehicles or investment vehicles that are available to young people today.
Michael Rolnick helped create financial football for Visa.
This is to get kids started, and we can't overwhelm someone and make it daunting. And that's why I think the game packaging really helps get this education message across.
For more sophisticated stuff, Rolnick refers people to the website practicalmoneyskills.com. It's got college and graduate school level curriculums. As for our high school students, will they give it a try outside the classroom?
Yeah, I'll check it out, yeah.
I asked Jacques Landry how financial football compares to the video games he normally plays.
It's good, but it's education when you learn stuff. Even if you don't have the right answer, you learn something. It's good to play games like this.
Saints cornerback Mike McKenzie says playing this game is a first step.
And getting into the next step, which is investing, but you have to talk to them about saving it because it's hard to invest when you don't have anything.
Financial football has been adopted by schools in 7 states. The Visa spokesman says there's a reason his company is involved in teaching kids. He says responsible consumers make better long-term clients. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, all you gamers out there, get ready for Battlefield version free. Not free, free. Video game publisher Electronic Arts says the latest in its Battlefield series, called Battlefield Heroes, will be available this summer as a free download. EA says it'll use in-game advertising to support the cost of the product. Users will also have to pay to add things like clothing and equipment to game characters. The in-game ad market is expected to top $700 million in the U.S. by 2010. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the markets were closed for the holiday. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Next time on the program, the virtual world Second Life gets hit with a dose of economic reality.
I just logged in a few days ago. I usually go and visit all these different brand sites, and most of them are either closed up or if they're still open, it's a ghost town.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.